Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Anna Mateo, Jill Robbins, and Pete Musto. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, says hate crimes rose across the United States in 2016 for the second year in a row. An FBI study released Monday reports there were 6,121 hate crime incidents last year, an increase of 4.6% from 2015. It was the first time since 2004 that U.S. hate crimes rose 2 years in a row. In 2015, hate crimes increased by 7%. The largest group of victims, 58%, were targeted because of race or ethnicity, the report said. Rising hate crimes were reported against several groups, including Arabs, Muslims, Jews, blacks, and transgender people. About 50% of these hate crimes were done because of anti-black bias. Nearly 21% involved anti-white bias, while 10% were anti-Hispanic or Latino crimes, the report said. About 3% resulted from anti-Asian bias, while nearly 4% of victims were American Indian or Alaska Native. About 1% involved anti-Arab crimes. Among hate crimes involving religion, the report said 54% were anti-Jewish, while 25% were anti-Muslim. Nearly 18% of reported hate crimes were based on the sexual orientation of victims. Of these 1,218 incidents, 63% involved anti-gay bias against men. The FBI has been gathering hate crime data since 1992. The agency's numbers are based completely on voluntary reporting from police agencies across the U.S. Therefore, the reports are widely believed to underreport the actual number of hate crimes. In releasing the new report, the FBI said hate crimes remain the number one investigative priority of its Civil Rights Division. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has also promised to make hate crimes a main focus of the Justice Department. Sessions said Monday the Justice Department is awaiting a full agency report on what steps to take to improve. The report is expected to suggest ways to better train investigators and prosecutors and improve collecting methods for hate crime data. I'm Brian Lynn.
Recently, two leading heart organizations changed the definition of what it means to have high blood pressure. Because of this change, the number of Americans with high blood pressure jumped from 32% to 46%. Doctors at the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology now classify anyone with a blood pressure reading of 130 over 80 as having high blood pressure. Before, the cutoffs for high blood pressure had been a top number of 140 and a lower number of 90. Health experts at the website Science Daily say blood pressure is defined by two numbers. The top number, called systolic, represents the force your heart pumps blood into the blood vessels. The bottom, called diastolic, is a measure of the resistance to the blood flow in the body's blood vessels. The American Heart Association says the new guidelines are designed to help people take steps to control their blood pressure earlier. High blood pressure can cause heart disease and stroke, the two leading causes of death in the world. The new guidelines set blood pressures in these categories: normal blood pressure, under 120 over 80. Elevated blood pressure, top number 120 to 129, and bottom number less than 80. High blood pressure stage 1, top number 130 to 139, or bottom number 80 to 89. High blood pressure stage 2, top number at least 140, or bottom number at least 90. A 2016 study by the World Health Organization and hundreds of scientists found that the number of people in the world with high blood pressure had reached 1.13 billion. However, the study defined high blood pressure as 140 over 90. Should they adopt the new guidelines, the number of people with high blood pressure worldwide will most likely increase. Scientists at Imperial College London led the study and looked at blood pressure measurements from nearly 20 million people from the years 1975 to 2015. In this study, they found that the number of people with high blood pressure nearly doubled in 40 years. Researchers found that over half of the world's adults with high blood pressure lived in Asia. Around 226 million people in China have high blood pressure, along with 200 million in India. This study also found that in 2015, people in South Korea, the USA, and Canada had the lowest high blood pressure rates in the world. With the new U.S. guidelines, the U.S. ranking in the world could change. The researchers from Imperial College London published their findings from the study in the January 2017 edition of the medical journal The Lancet. Health experts are warning people to not rush to medication to lower their high blood pressure. They advise that there are many lifestyle changes a person can make to effectively keep their blood pressure at a healthy level. Regular exercise and losing weight can lower your blood pressure. I'm Anna Mateo.
For the first time in 12 years, the number of new international students attending American colleges and universities has dropped. That information comes from the 2017 Open Doors Report on International Educational Exchange. The report is a project of the Institute of International Education, a not-for-profit group in the United States, and the U.S. Department of State. The findings were released on Monday. The Open Doors Report has been documenting international student exchanges at American colleges and universities since 1954. The 2016 to 2017 school year marked the second year in a row that over a million international students attended the schools.
This time, the number of new international college students was about 10,000 less than a year earlier. That represents an almost 3% decrease from the 2015 to 2016 school year. The latest Open Doors report did note a record year, with the largest number of international college students in the U.S. to date. But separately, the Institute of International Education noted a drop in the number of internationals seeking admission for the current school year. The average decrease, at almost 500 colleges and universities, was 7%. Alan Goodman is the president of the Institute, also known as the IIE. He said the main reason for the decrease is economics. The cost of higher education nationwide has been rising over the past 30 years. Goodman noted that the United States faces greater competition than ever to provide top-quality education. Countries and multinational employers around the world are competing to attract top talent, he said at a press conference Monday. As more countries implement national strategies to attract them, the competition will only intensify.
Goodman also noted cuts to several programs that sent many international college students to the U.S. in the past. For over 10 years, the government in Saudi Arabia spent billions of dollars so that its citizens could study in other countries. But in 2016, falling oil prices led the government to make cuts to that program. This resulted in a 14% decrease in the number of Saudi Arabian college students coming to the United States last year. Earlier this year, Brazil's Ministry of Education announced plans to cancel a similar program. Started in 2011, the program helped send over 100,000 university students overseas to study the sciences. The new report noted that the number of Brazilians attending American colleges and universities dropped by about 32%. However, some experts argue it is not just economics that are affecting the decrease in international students. Philip Altbach directs the Center for International Higher Education in the Lynch School of Education at Boston College. Last year, he predicted a decrease in the number of international students coming to the U.S. His predictions were published in several opinion pieces.
So why is the United States suddenly less appealing? Altbach thinks the policies and behavior of President Donald Trump are partly to blame. And he believes those policies and actions could lead to fewer international students in the years to come. The U.S. is seen as an unwelcoming country in the age of Trump, Altbach told VOA. This is combined with both the perception and the reality that it is more difficult to obtain a U.S. visa than it used to be. The U.S. remains the strongest system in the world, but negative forces grow ever stronger. In the first month of his presidency, Trump announced a temporary ban on travel to the U.S. by citizens of several Middle Eastern countries. And in September, he announced an expansion of that ban to include other countries, such as Venezuela and North Korea.
But Marianne Craven argues that politics and other issues are not the only influences on people's decisions to study in the United States. Craven is the Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary for Academic Programs for the State Department. She says that international students are much more concerned with the future an American education can offer them. Students make their choices of where to study with their long-term goals and career plans in mind, Craven told VOA. She added, "These are very personal decisions by students and their families."
Craven says the State Department's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs plans to continue building friendly relations between the U.S. and other countries. It plans to do so through educational, cultural, sports, and professional exchanges. The number of people attending events designed to publicize American higher education in other countries remains strong, Craven adds. While the United States may be facing a decrease in the number of new foreign college students, Canada is becoming more appealing. Between 2008 and 2015, the total number of international students at Canadian colleges and universities increased by about 92%. A decrease in the number of international college students at American colleges and universities could affect the U.S. economy. The Department of Commerce reports that international students added about $39 billion to the economy last year. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we finish the story of the first 13 American colonies. We will also tell about how the Southern colonies developed. Here is Steve Ember.
Among the southern colonies, the northernmost was Maryland. The King of England, Charles I, gave the land between Virginia and Pennsylvania to George Calvert in 1632. George Calvert was also known as Lord Baltimore. He wanted to start a colony with greater religious freedoms than existed in England. Calvert was Roman Catholic. Catholics could not openly observe their religion in England. They also had to pay money to the government because they did not belong to the Anglican Church, the Church of England. George Calvert never saw the colony that was named Maryland. He died soon after he received the documents giving him the land. The land went to his son, Cecil Calvert, who became the next Lord Baltimore. He had the power to collect taxes, fight wars, make laws, and create courts in Maryland. Cecil named his brother Leonard as the colony's first governor. Cecil Calvert believed that English Catholics could live in peace in Maryland alongside Protestants. So he urged Catholics in England to move there. To get more settlers, he allowed people to own farms and gave them some power in local politics. Some Catholics did go to Maryland, but not as many as he hoped. Protestants were in the majority. In 1649, Lord Baltimore accepted a Toleration Act passed by the local government. It guaranteed freedom of religion, but only for Christians. King Charles II gave away more land in America in 1663. He gave 8 English lords the territory known as Carolina. It extended south from Virginia into Florida, an area controlled by Spain. Spain also claimed the southern part of Carolina. Spanish, French, and English settlers had tried earlier to populate the area. The 8 new owners promised 40 hectares of land to anyone who would go to Carolina to live. They also promised religious freedom. The first successful Carolina settlers left England in 1670. They built a town in an area where two rivers met. They called it Charlestown for King Charles. Spanish ships attacked the port city many times, but the settlers defended their land. The settlers planted all kinds of crops to see what would grow best. They found that rice was just right for the hot, humid conditions. Also, their cattle and pigs did so well that the Carolina settlers started selling meat to the West Indies. Many of Charlestown's settlers came from Barbados, a port used in the West Indies slave trade. The settlers began buying black slaves to help grow the rice. By 1708, more blacks than whites lived in the southern part of Carolina. The success of the farming economy depended on slave labor. The northern part of the Carolina colony grew much more slowly than the southern part. Many settlers in the northern part were from neighboring Virginia. Some had left Virginia because people who disagreed with the Anglican Church were not welcome there. Historians say the area that became North Carolina may have been the most democratic of all the colonies. The people generally did not interfere in each other's lives. Together, they faced a common enemy, the pirates, who made the North Carolina coast their home base. In 1677, some of the people in the northern part of the Carolina Territory rebelled against England. They did not like England's Navigation Acts. These laws forced people in Carolina to pay taxes to England on goods sold to other colonies. Some northern Carolina settlers refused to pay this tax. These independent thinkers even set up their own government and tried to break free of England. But the English soldiers in the colonies stopped the rebellion by arresting its leader. There were growing differences between the people of Northern Carolina and Southern Carolina. Finally, the owners of the colony divided it in 1712. Forming what would become the states of North Carolina and South Carolina. The last English colony founded in the New World was Georgia. It was established in 1732 under King George II. Georgia was the idea of a man named James Oglethorpe. He wanted to solve a problem in England involving a growing number of people who could not repay their debts. At that time, debtors were put in prison. This made it impossible for them to earn the money they needed to get out of debt. Oglethorpe wanted to create a colony where debtors could go instead of going to prison. He wanted it to be a place where people could have good lives while they worked to earn money. But not many debtors wanted to go to Georgia. The people who did settle there were much like the people in the other colonies. They did not agree with all of Oglethorpe's ideas. They wanted to do things he did not believe were right, like drinking alcohol and owning slaves. In the end, the settlers won. They rejected Oglethorpe's ideas about how they should live. Life was not easy in Georgia. Spaniards and pirates captured ships along the coast. Spain controlled Florida and also claimed Georgia and the Carolinas. Border fights were common. Oglethorpe lost all his money trying to establish Georgia. King George took control of the colony in 1752. As new colonies were being established nearby, the colony of Virginia was growing. A way of life was developing there that was very different from that of the North. Most people in Virginia at this time were members of the Church of England. Religion was not as important a part of their lives as it was to the people in the North. In the New England colonies, members of the clergy were considered the most important. In the southern colonies, rich land owners were the most important. People in Virginia did not live in towns as people did in Massachusetts. They lived along rivers, on small farms, or on large farms called plantations. Being located on a river made it easy to export goods by ship. Virginians were sending large amounts of tobacco to England. It was the crop that earned them the most money. But growing tobacco breaks down the soil. After a few years, nothing grew well on land that had been planted with tobacco. The farmers had to stop planting anything on the land every few years. That meant they needed a lot of land. They also needed a large workforce. So tobacco farmers in Virginia began to buy land and workers. At first, they bought the services of indentured servants, poor people who had no money or jobs. These indentured servants agreed to work for a farmer for a period of 4 to 7 years. After that, they were free to work for themselves. In 1619, a Dutch ship brought a group of Africans to Jamestown. They had been kidnapped from their homes by African traders and sold to the ship's captain. He sold them to the Virginia settlers. These first Africans may have been treated like indentured servants. Later, however, colonists decided to keep them as slaves so they would not have to continue paying for workers. Slowly, laws were approved in Virginia that made it legal to keep black people as slaves. By 1750, there were more Africans in Virginia than any other group. Indians did not make good slaves because they could run away. The slaves from Africa could not. They had no place to go. Slavery in the South affected the course of American history. It divided the people and led to a civil war that nearly tore the nation apart.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.